we have Reedsburg High School Equivalency Diploma Program. Would they please stand? A welcome to you all. You may be seated. And we have Boscobel High School. Would you all stand? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. These students are here with us today with the Court with Class program. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. We give them materials about the case that they're going to hear, and some of the schools invite lawyers to discuss the case with the students, and then the students come here to listen to the oral argument. They also meet with a justice of the court at noon to discuss the procedures of the court in deciding cases and not the substance of the case. And anyone in the courtroom who wishes to attend this noon session is welcome to do so. Now that we've met you, I'd like to introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The students will meet with Justice Bradley at noon. They were supposed to have met with me, but as you will soon hear when I dissolve into coughing, that I'm not in very good shape. It's bad enough I'm contaminating my colleagues. I'd just as soon not get to contaminate the students. We left off with you, Justice Bradley. You'll feel better by noon. To my immediate right is Justice William Bablich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the sick Chief Justice. On my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we'll proceed to our first case, 00-1635, State Ex Rel Gary Tate versus David Swartz. The first speaker will be Attorney James F. Booting, who will represent Mr. Tate. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's actually Jerome Booting.
I'm sorry, Counsel.
That's okay.
We can't hear you.
It's actually Jerome Booting, not James.
Booting. Sorry.
That's okay. May it please the court and counsel, there are no major factual disputes presented by this case and really a great deal of agreement on what the legal principles involved are. And I want to start with what those points of agreement are. The Court of Appeals, Mr. Tate, and now finally the Department of Corrections all agree that a probationer should not have his probation revoked simply because he refuses to admit in sex offender treatment setting the underlying facts of his conviction while a direct appeal is pending. And yet that's exactly what happened in Mr. Tate's case, because initially and until very recently the Department of Corrections didn't seem to recognize that his Fifth Amendment right survived into that those circumstances. Now finally, after Mr. Tate has spent about 3.5 years in prison, the department, I think, recognizes the error of revoking him solely for that reason.
Well, where is he now?
He is in prison in Whiteville, Tennessee.
And this is on the basis of revocation of probation?
Yes.
And so the department has not removed him?
No. He's remained in custody ever since he was revoked.
Even though the department concedes that that was an erroneous revocation?
That's correct.
Well, doesn't the department concede it's an erroneous revocation?
I believe they do, and of course Mr. Wolford can address that, but in their brief, they're asking for
a hearing.
Yes, that his probation revocation be vacated and that it be returned for a hearing.
Don't they indicate if desired?
If desired, correct.
And isn't that basically the same thing that the court did in State versus Evans? Said you can have another hearing
if
desired?
Right. That's exactly what Evans did. And actually, that would not be a precise remedy for this case, because what really should happen is that it should be remanded and he be permitted to go into sex offender treatment and then be advised of an Evans-type immunity, whatever this court decides to craft in terms of that immunity, that be told in that setting, just like Evans was in the revocation hearing setting, that anything he says can't be used against him in a subsequent criminal proceeding.
But you would oppose a remand for another hearing even if it's desired, is that right?
Right. I really don't think that's proper, because he's already had the hearing. He always had an Evans immunity at the hearing itself. He's not being revoked because of that. He was revoked because of the failure to admit in the treatment setting.
Can I explore for a minute some of the other areas where there seems to be disagreement?
Sure.
It's my understanding that everybody agrees that this court should adopt the State versus Evans rule. But apparently you've got a disagreement in regard to the scope of such a rule. Is that right?
That's right.
And it's my understanding that there's an argument as to whether or not that should be after trial only, or whether it should include those persons who have been convicted on a plea of guilty or no contest. Is that a dispute?
Yes, it is.
And is there also a dispute in regard to the issue of uncharged criminal conduct?
Yes.
You think the new rule should cover that as well?
Right.
Why do you think that should be covered when it's not an issue in this case?
Well, it's not precisely presented by the facts of this case. However, what the court, it's close enough to the facts of this case that I think the court should address it. Unlike one other area of disagreement, which is the question of whether it should apply in a prison setting, the Wachtel amicus brief suggests that it should even extend to that. But, you know, I recognize clearly those facts aren't presented here, and I think that the court should be cautious in trying to fashion some remedy that would apply in something that far afield of the facts of this case. But I think if we look at both of those issues, whether it should apply when someone's been convicted on a trial or a guilty plea, I don't see any reason for the distinction. If the court's going to apply an immunity, it's because the Fifth Amendment applies. And Fifth Amendment applies in that setting while a direct appeal is pending, whether or not someone's been convicted by some sort of plea or whether they've gone to trial. The question about whether it should apply only to the facts of the underlying conviction versus other criminal misconduct, I think, if we look at Evans itself, Evans didn't limit itself to only admissions to a probation agent or at a revocation hearing concerning the underlying conviction. Indeed, Evans involved a different crime. He was on probation for, I believe, a sex offense, and then he was questioned about a murder and rape that occurred. A completely different, uncharged crime. And what the court held is that the competing balance between Fifth Amendment rights of an individual and society's right to have adequate supervision if someone's on probation meant that the best way to resolve that was to give immunity to a defendant who's being asked on probation specific questions about criminal misconduct. So Evans really applies to any questions of misconduct.
You've got, if I might interrupt for a minute, you've also got the McCune case coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court this past spring. And at least the way I read that case, it would seem that they were putting their stamp of approval on a situation where there could be questions required to be answered concerning responsibility in regard to a sexual history Now, I read that as getting into other inappropriate acts. I recognize that that's within a prison setting rather than in a probation revocation setting. But don't you think that's a significant determination by the U.S. Supreme Court that we should pay some heed to?
Well, the decision's a little bit confusing because there's Justice Kennedy's opinion has joined in with four of them. The dissent has four, and then Justice O'Connor is sort of in the middle and ultimately rules with the majority, but she makes it pretty clear that the reason she's ruling, and I think the law is that when there's a split like that, what we have to do is find the area of common agreement, and that's what the law is. And the area of common agreement basically is that, as Justice O'Connor said, that the compulsion, the compelled factor of Fifth Amendment analysis wasn't satisfied in that case because she viewed it the penalty that was going to be would befall the inmate was minor in her view. It was simply loss of television privileges and some visitation things. And I don't think anybody would disagree that the penalty that results in the revocation of your probation is certainly severe and satisfies the compulsion element of the Fifth Amendment. So I think that case really doesn't change anything for us here. It may ultimately, if we're dealing with a situation of what kind of treatment programs might be required in a prison setting to an inmate, it may ultimately have some relevance there, but I don't think it applies in a situation where someone's on probation and being asked in sex offender treatment to make such admissions.
I have a question for you. How long is he allowed to claim the privilege of the Fifth? Now, when this case started, he had an appeal pending. And if he had won that appeal, which is on legal grounds, he might have had a new trial, at which point what he said in treatment would be important in the new trial, right?
Right.
That appeal concluded.
That's correct.
And he lost.
Right.
So he's not in jeopardy of a new trial.
That's right. Although he is about to pursue federal habeas relief, nevertheless, the direct appeal was completed.
Direct appeal. So your position, because I was going to try and say, isn't this case moot? Your position, he's still in jeopardy of a new trial if he wins on a federal habeas.
He is, but also, and this is one of the reasons why I think it's important to look not only at the
charge, but the other charges,
but other possible offenses, including he testified at the trial in this case. And if he's forced to now admit in treatment something otherwise, then he would potentially face the possibility of perjury prosecution, which would be based solely on the compelled statements from him while he's on probation and sex offender treatment. So it's true that after the appeal process is over, he no longer has a Fifth Amendment concern as to the underlying charge because there's no real and appreciable fear of incrimination in a subsequent proceeding as to those facts. But there are many other circumstances where, even if he isn't charged, for instance, under the greater latitude rule, it's possible that admissions that he could make in treatment could be used against him at another trial, even if he's not charged for those incidents.
Counsel, Justice Crook started us on the process of finding out just where you and the state differ, because this case has changed a bit
Yes. As
we've proceeded. Now, the first issue that might have been in contest was a waiver,
Right. Which
is what the Court of Appeals relied on. Now, you still say it wasn't waived. My understanding is the state agrees with you, but I'll check that out with the state. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
So you're not going to spend time
arguing.
Well, I would like to address it briefly, just in case any of the members of the court have any concerns, even if the state concedes. I mean, you may feel differently.
That's a good point. Okay. The second is whether it affects everyone or it affects only those who pled not guilty and had a trial, right? That's where there's a difference.
Right.
Another difference is, as Justice Crooks noted, uncharged conduct, right?
Right.
Another difference is impeachment, right? Whether or not anything said could be used in impeachment.
I don't think, and you can certainly ask that of the state, I don't think they're really...
Pushing on that?
It seemed like it initially, and that's why we replied, but I think State versus Thompson or Minnesota versus Murphy...
Right, but that was a modification on Evans.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll check with the state on that, okay? All right. And then let's see what the other notes I have on this. I think that's it. Immunity to no contest or guilty. You'd say yes. That you should grant immunity to no. Okay. So those are the issues, the appeals, waiver, scope of the rule, uncharged conduct, and impeachment, which may or may not be an issue.
Right.
Okay. Anything else in which you think you and the state disagree?
Just what the actual remedy should be, and I think...
Okay, remedy. And whether you need a hearing.
Right.
Okay. Which we've explored. Okay.
All right. If I could address...
And now you're free to address any or all of them.
Okay. First of all, waiver, I think... That's why we're here, really, because the Court of Appeals agreed with us that it was a violation of his Fifth Amendment rights to revoke him solely for that reason. But they nevertheless upheld the revocation on the technicality of waiver, which I think is unsupported in the case law or really public policy case law. And I cited the cases in my brief where there's a long history of where defendants have been allowed to litigate or challenge conditions of probation through the writ of certiorari and revocation of probation process rather than having to do a separate appeal on some motion to the trial court. The Court of Appeals ruled that way in a very brief paragraph. It didn't cite any cases in support of it, and really there are none, and which makes it doubly unfair to Mr. Tate to apply in his circumstance because he had no reasonable means of believing that this procedure that they suggest should be done had to be done. And that is, what the Court of Appeals says is that they avoid the whole conflict by saying a defendant in Mr. Tate's situation should go to the trial court, ask that sex offender treatment be delayed until the conclusion of the direct appeal. Now, there's no cases that have ever held that, but it's also very bad public policy, I think. And I think that's why the Department of Correction certainly is opposed to that sort of a remedy as well. What it does is it leaves untreated sex offenders running around in the community for potentially years while the case is pending on appeal. And that's certainly in no one's interest. But it also requires duplicative appeals. It's a waste of judicial resources to have two different appeals, parallel appeals, going on with virtually the same issues. And that's what they say would have to be done. Now, I don't think there's anything that would prohibit that approach, and in fact, that's what Mr. Tate did initially, was to file a motion in the trial court to modify his probation to delay, or either to delay his treatment or to allow him to continue in treatment without having to make admissions. But that was filed before the revocation process proceeded, and ultimately the trial court ruled that it wasn't ripe, for one thing, because there hadn't been any actual revocation yet. The timing was a little bit overlapping, because by the time she ruled that, in fact, there had been a revocation started, but at the time, but she was unaware of that, because it was not when we filed it. It's also contrary to the basic idea behind waiver, which is that it's applied if the question isn't presented below, and the opposing party is then denied an opportunity to address it, and the trial court potentially correct an error. So, you know, none of that happened here. It was clear to everyone from all stages of this proceeding that Mr. Tate was saying he was appealing his case, he had a lawyer, he was afraid that any admissions he would make in treatment would not be privileged because evidence didn't apply in that setting, and that therefore he would be incriminating himself if he got a new trial. And so that issue's been amply briefed below by the parties as well. So I really see no sufficient reasons for a waiver situation to be applied in this case.
How would an Evans type immunity apply in a Chapter 980 commitment?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's one I've thought of, but it's one where I know I don't think this court has to go with this case because those facts aren't presented.
The treatment programs are very similar, though, aren't they, Matt?
Well, they're similar, but they're different. I think, first of all, there's different liberty interests at stake. When someone's on probation out in the community versus when someone is actually in prison, someone in prison has less rights, frankly, and is subject to the control of the department to a greater degree.
Somebody committed under Chapter 980 is not in prison.
Well, I'm assuming, maybe I misunderstood the question. I thought it would be before.
Why did you use the word institutionalized?
Right. But he's not getting out unless he satisfactorily completes treatments.
Right.
In which he will be required to admit not only the conduct which led to his incarceration, which led to his 980 commitment, but anything else in his background.
I think ultimately this court's going to have to face that question squarely, because I think that's going to come.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. What the question is that the court's going to face. He's in 980 treatment, and he doesn't want to, and he denies that he committed the crime. Right? So then what's the issue before the court in 980?
In that hypothetical, well, if his direct appeal is over, which in all likelihood would be, he wouldn't have a Fifth Amendment right as to the offense of conviction. But the question, as I understood it, might be more what if he's asked about other misconduct?
That would be the uncharged conduct.
The uncharged stuff. And let's say he refuses to discuss the sexual history, and therefore he's not allowed to be released from the institution because of that.
And I ask the question because one of the issues that we have to decide here is how narrowly or broadly to draw this immunity rule.
Well, I think the concern that is being expressed, it would have a direct impact on these programs. I'm talking about when you come into a sexual offender program, one of the key things is, you know, fess up or admit so that we can work with you. And I'm just trying to, if we give a measured response or, yes, there are these rights, how far do they extend and how will that affect this program? Because literally, everyone can say, yes, I'm, you know, I didn't do it, and therefore I don't want to, I won't participate in the program or it won't be effective, and that really delays a lot of the effectiveness of any of these programs.
Well, first of all, if someone's direct appeal is concluded and they still refuse to admit or discuss the facts of the underlying conviction, then even given the Evans kind of immunity that we're proposing here, the department, I think, could revoke because he would not have any real and appreciable fear. And that would be, I think that would apply in the 980 situation as well. But I think the difference is then is as to other uncharged conduct. And I don't think that this court needs to craft an immunity that's so broad that covers that situation because the 980 situation involves some different perturbations, so to speak, in that the whole question of the compulsion element it will come more into play in that situation. It's closer to McCune versus Lyle than the case we have here.
Because he's already locked up.
Because he's already locked up. And here, it's a question of...
He doesn't have a very good shot at getting out anyway.
That could be. But ultimately, I think the court would have to analyze it under some of the McCune versus Lyle, the penalty cases, and decide, you know, is the penalty that he's getting enough to constitute violation of the Fifth Amendment?
Well, in a Chapter 980, the penalty is perpetual institutionalization. It's not loss of TV privileges or placement in a more restrictive rather than less restrictive prison setting, but perpetual incarceration.
And I don't want to be misunderstood. I personally think that, that ultimately this court should rule that way, that the Fifth Amendment, that this immunity should apply in that kind of a setting. What I'm saying is I don't think that that matter really has to be ruled on today by this court in this case, and I think ultimately there needs to be more briefing on that issue and more facts developed as to exactly how what alternative there might be as far as treatment in the prison setting short of forcing someone to admit to all of these things.
But you've got a problem because of perjury here.
That's right.
Right,
a special problem.
Yeah, he is perpetually exposed to a perjury charge because he took the stand and denied the conduct.
That's right. So if he's forced to admit in treatment now, even with his direct appeal concluded, if that admission could be used against him in a subsequent criminal proceeding, perjury trial, he obviously would be incriminating himself by being forced to make those statements.
And as far as other conduct is concerned, he is also perpetually exposed.
That's right. And as is any probationer who is asked questions not by the treatment therapist, but by the probation agent. But that's already covered by Evans. If someone's asked by the probation agent, he's got immunity. So I see no reason why someone would get that kind of immunity for uncharged conduct with as to discussions with the probation agent, but not with the treatment provider. I mean, after all, what are we trying to do with treatment here? We want people to be open, to be able to freely discuss what their history is and their problems so that they can be rehabilitated. And if we're saying that, nevertheless, what you say, if you look at Mr. Hanger's release, is so broad that, you know, whatever you say can be used against you in a criminal proceeding, then you're undercutting the whole purpose behind treatment.
Sort of like patient-doctor privilege.
Yes.
That's the probationer officer privilege because you want an open dialogue, so you give them immunity.
Right.
And so you're saying here it's treatment, you ought to give them immunity.
Right. And for public policy reasons, that's appropriate, and also as a reasonable way to resolve society's legitimate interest in seeing that these people are rehabilitated.
Where is there evidence that tells us that you can't get treated unless you admit liability? I mean, I've seen this in court cases, and so then I'm all set to say, hey, no treatment unless you admit. Then I see this case, and it has a deniers club. So obviously there are a lot of people who are denying, and they have treatment, and they have a special group for treatment. So where is this doctrine that you ain't going to get no treatment unless you fess up?
There's really a conflict in the scientific research on whether that's necessary, and I believe the amicus brief contains a reference to an authority that revealed in a study that there was really no higher incidence of recidivism for those who are in treatment but never admitted versus those who were forced to admit. But
so the court shouldn't just blithely assume that, nor should the Department of Corrections, that you gotta mess up before you can get treatment.
I don't think so, but the
no, this is not a Daubert state, but maybe under Daubert you wouldn't accept that.
I certainly think there would be a battle with the trial court as the gatekeeper and hearing the various different experts on whether that's really necessary. In fact, many think that it's better. And you know, they have these denier groups because people do. Some people who are. I need my lights on. Should I finish?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Some people who are convicted really are guilty and really need to get past the denial stage. And so I think Justice Ziegler, or I mean Judge Ziegler, recognized that when she put him on probation instead of prison, and that there would be a period of time where she would expect that he would be still in a denial stance, but that he would work through that in treatment. They only gave him less than 2 months here. But I think that's why there are denier groups, is because some people really need some time.
Thank you, Mr. Buting. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General William C. Wolford, representing David Schwartz, who's the Administrator of the Division of Hearings and Appeals.
Thank you. My name is William C. Wolford. I'm representing the respondent, Mr. Schwartz, in this case. This case requires the court to establish a remedy to achieve the goals of protection of the public and rehabilitation of the probationer while preserving the probationer's right against self-incrimination. This court has recognized that it is the central tenet of sex offender treatment to require the offender to admit his or her guilt for the crime for which the offender has been convicted. Since untreated sex offenders pose a risk in the community, a sex offender's refusal to admit guilt makes it difficult for the offender's probation officer to ensure the safety of the community. The Court of Appeals sought to balance the competing interests in this case by providing a remedy that would result in a delay in treatment. The Court of Appeals stated that the probationer must move the trial court to delay sex offender treatment until the probationer's direct appeal is disposed of, and that if necessary, the term of the probation could be extended until treatment is completed. The Department of Corrections does not believe that delaying sex offender treatment is the best solution to resolving the competing interests in this case. DOC believes that probationers need to enter into sex offender treatment as soon as possible, rather than after their appellate remedies are concluded. Therefore, they believe that a grant of immunity to these probationers required to admit the conduct underlying their sexual offense convictions as part of sex offender treatment is the best solution to achieving the goals of protection of the public, rehabilitation of the probationer, and preservation of the probationer's right against
self-incrimination. Mr. Wolford, does your whole case rely on our accepting the scientific proposition that there has to be confession?
Well,
is that the whole basis of your case? If so, don't we need some more evidence than we have?
This court has said in state action.
I know. What was its evidence? I know it said that. What is this evidence that it cited?
I don't remember this. There were various studies, I think, cited in that case, and I understand that in the briefs in opposition here, there was a contrary position taking place. But I think the majority of treatment officials believe that that removing the denial is important, and that is a first step. I think that's recognized in Lyle versus McCune as well. And the Department of Corrections has been given the authority by the legislature to treat these people, and I think we should rely on their belief that this is the way to go.
Okay, so that's the department's position, and that's your basis. Now, if we can just set forth the issues. You're here, and do you support the Court of Appeals' decision that there was waiver here?
The Department of Corrections believes that that is not the best approach to dealing with this case because it results in a delay in treatment, and they feel that treatment should start right away. Therefore, we're we're not relying on the waiver issue in the Court of Appeals, and we're suggesting this Evans-type approach because we think it's a better solution to deal with the competing interests.
Well, as I understood it, this concept of waiver, because you didn't appeal from the revocation or from the condition of probation, is contrary to several cases. Is that true?
I don't know if it's contrary to cases. There are cases where challenges to conditions of probation have been raised in certiorari proceedings. I don't think in those cases there was any challenge to that or a claim that there was waiver because it wasn't raised before. So I don't think they really decided that question. There are also cases, Oakley, Simonetto, Carrizales, which is a, you know, very closely related to this case, where the challenge to the condition did come before any revocation. Certainly you couldn't and have been able to raise challenges by certiorari in the past. We concede that.
Your only argument in your brief relates to what kind of immunity should be given.
That's correct.
You seem to say there should be immunity, and you go right into the merits. Do you want the court to rule there was waiver here?
No.
Then we never have to get into anything else.
No, we don't want you to rule that there was waiver.
You want us to get to the issue of immunity?
Yes.
All right. Is there
Chief, if I may, just for clarification, do you believe that the Court of Appeals erred in its application of waiver? I'm sorry, but the question suggests, your answer to me before suggests that you don't want us to decide it on waiver, but I want to know whether or not you think the Court of Appeals erred in its application of waiver.
I don't know if it erred, but we think the policy is not the proper one, particularly if it's read as extending to things broader than the particular situation in this case.
Thank you.
Did the Court of Appeals have any authority at all for their waiver rule?
They cited nothing specifically.
Do you have any cites to authorize and back their position?
One thing I would suggest is that we talked about certiorari as being a method by which conditions of probation have been challenged in the past. There is the doctrine of latches is applicable in a certiorari case, and it would seem consistent with latches that if you have a condition of probation that is conflicting with some right, that you should take action to get rid of that conflict immediately rather than waiting till after revocation.
Was there any latches here?
I think you could argue that it would be consistent to say there was latches, but I have no specific cases to say.
And was there latches in this case, if we even accepted that doctrine?
Well, they certainly were challenging the case. The problem here was that they didn't appeal from the trial court's denial.
No, but they appealed from...
They were raising the issue.
Right, okay. So the issue is, as you see it, the scope of any immunity, whether it should deal with people who have pled guilty or are for it or no contest.
I'll come back to that in just a second. Let me just get rid of one apparent bit of confusion about what our position is. We are not claiming that it should be an Evans-type rule without modification by Thompson.
So that's the impeachment issue.
Yes.
Okay, so the state is with the defendant that you've got Evans, and they can't use it on... for impeachment purposes. Okay. I was going to get there. That's good. Okay. So the scope of the rule. Here we have a plea of not guilty in a jury trial.
Right.
You think it should be limited to that? That is a plea of not guilty in some trial.
Well, I think that the basis for saying that it should not apply where there's been a no contest plea or a guilty plea is really Carrizales, and Carrizales is kind of hard to understand what the basis is for it. If it simply is that Carrizales had no appeal pending, then I think this court's decision in Marks provides support for the conclusion that a probationer could claim the privilege even if he had pled guilty or no contest, if he had an appeal pending challenging the conviction, or if the time to withdraw the plea had not expired and he had a good faith intention of challenging the conviction. Marks talks about having a common law right of a year to bring a motion to withdraw a plea within 1 year of conviction. And one of the briefs in this case does mention the fact that you can plead guilty, but you can still challenge, bring a motion challenging the suppression of evidence. In that type of situation, it would seem appropriate to allow a plea of self-incrimination and therefore to provide immunity in that type of situation.
You also bring a motion for modification of sentence.
Yes, and I understand that in Marks they say that there is a right to claim the privilege in that case if there's an appreciable chance of success. We really agree with the concurrence in that opinion that it shouldn't be extended to a sentence modification motion. I don't see that, at least if they're not attacking the conviction, if it's simply a motion for modification of sentence, I don't see what the penalty is there. The sentence can be reduced, but it's not going to be increased because of any admission that's made in sex offender treatment. So we would oppose extending the immunity type rule to the sentence modification situation.
So as I hear you, you don't limit the scope of evidence modified immunity to just not guilty, please. I mean, there's a little wedge in there.
We think it, based on Marks, it would be logical if there is a motion pending or an appeal pending trying to withdraw a plea or challenging the suppression of evidence, that immunity could be extended in that situation.
So court should be very wary of deciding that issue, just saying it doesn't apply to guilty pleas.
I think that that's something that you may want to consider carefully. Yes.
Okay. All right. The next one is as to uncharged conduct. I gather it's the Department of Corrections view that for treatment, you not only have to fess up to what you were convicted of, but you have to fess up to uncharged conduct. Is that true?
Well, of course, everything I'm telling you here is not on the record in this case. And that's one of the reasons why it's always dangerous to extend a rule that you're creating because you don't really know what is happening. But my understanding of the way that they approached uncharged conduct in the sex offender treatment area is that they want to know about the sexual history of a person because they think it will help the offender deal with the more effectively get treatment, and so they but they intend to ask very general questions and tell them, assuming the court goes along with this, that they won't be receiving immunity and that they shouldn't provide evidence or information so specific, admissions so specific, that they will be able to identify prior uncharged crimes. In other words, it's just kind of general background information.
That seems unworkable to me.
If I were closing my eyes and pretending I were a sex therapist and in a sex offender program, and to say, okay, for treatment, I want to know generally about your assaulting the neighborhood girl that you referenced yesterday, and I need this to hear about this uncharged crime for treatment, but don't give me any specifics, and by the way, you have the right to remain silent, you have, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that just doesn't seem workable to me. This is a kind of, I'm sort of asking and you're sort of telling policy. Is that it?
I think they're trying to find out the general types of victims, that sort of thing, as opposed to, they may not even want information as specific as the fact that it was a neighbor or whatever. They certainly wouldn't want dates. That sort of this is not a subterfuge. I mean, they're not trying to do this in order to
Come
to the DA and prosecute.
It just seems unworkable. Tell us vaguely what you're talking about. I mean, I just can't play it out in my mind for it to be realistic. We can write it. We can order it. We can decide it. But I don't think it works.
Well, then I would urge you not to deal with it at all in this case, and let it come up before, in a case with some concrete facts.
Well, and what will the department do? Continue to give this instruction? You got to tell us, otherwise we're going to revoke probation, because we need this information. But if you tell us, you're not going to receive immunity.
I think that they, obviously they'll wait to see what the decision says, but I think that they are using this sort of practice in some respect right now, and I'm not aware of any cases ever or prosecutions ever arising out of it.
Well, suppose I'm the sex offender and I get the information that, the instruction that Justice Bradley just said, and I say, what? I think I need a lawyer. You're going to talk about immunity. You're going to talk about other crimes. I need a lawyer. What are you going to do? I want a lawyer who represents me to explain this all to me.
I don't know if they have a right to a lawyer in that type of situation. I wouldn't think that they would.
All right, so then you say, we're not giving you a lawyer. You want a lawyer, go out and hire your own lawyer. And I say, well, you know, I'm destitute. The public defender won't represent me because I'm not within the framework of who they can represent. So I then tell the treatment officer, well, there were 10 neighborhood kids that I had sexual contact with. What does the treatment officer go tell the DA, or tell the Department of Correction, who tells the DA? What's the process here?
I think that the Department of Correction believes that they had specific enough information.
They probably would provide that information. I'm not aware that it's ever happened.
Is that then the equivalent of a custodial interrogation by an agent of the state?
I don't think that it is, but I don't know. I really haven't dealt with the situation.
Well, you're giving a kind of Miranda warning. You're saying anything that you say can be used against you. Don't tell us too much. Just tell us enough to get over this barrier of treatment information. I mean, I think that's the point of the custodial question.
I think,
point am I asking about counsel?
I think one of the things that is different here from the facts presented in this particular case is that the sex offender treatment people don't really know what the offender has done, so they're really not in a position to determine too well whether they're cooperating or not cooperating, because they don't know what's not being admitted to or what the facts are. That makes it much more difficult to go run to the authorities or to try to revoke somebody's probation or whatever.
What about the perjury issue?
I guess I should clarify. I don't know if we're talking about whether this situation is implicit in your questions, but our position is that when you're talking about sex offender treatment in institutions as opposed to probationers, that there is no issue here at all because of McCune versus Lyle, that there's no compulsion,
no compulsion.
You shouldn't address that, you know, that type of situation in this
case. We shouldn't address Chapter 980.
I don't believe that a person can claim the privilege against self-incrimination because it will have an effect on what happens in Chapter 980, because I don't think Chapter 980 is criminal.
But back to this situation, then, the threat of being flunked out of sex offender treatment and revoked is pretty significant compulsion, isn't it?
Revoked in what respect?
Revoked off of probation and sent to prison to serve the state sentence. And this takes it outside of McCune.
Well, we're conceding that if you're threatening to revoke someone's probation, that is compulsion.
I thought I heard you say something to the contrary, which is...
No, I was talking about sex predator, the sex predator Chapter
980
cases.
You're talking about someone who's institutionalized under 980.
Yes.
You don't think that would be compulsion because they're already institutionalized. You think that's under McCune.
I don't think they have the right to claim the privilege, because I don't think that the effect is penal. They don't have a real and appreciable fear of self-incrimination because it's not a criminal proceeding.
Just as an aside, if I recall in McCune, the lead for the way that the opinion was approached was more from the perspective, or was from the perspective of what is the severity of the consequences, as opposed to any implication of Fifth Amendment privilege. Am I right or am I wrong in my recollection of McCune with regard to the lead four, that's what they based their opinion on, the severity of the consequences rather than the Fifth?
Well, I think both the lead opinion and, as I recall, Justice O'Connor was the Fifth.
Yes.
Decided the case on the basis of the fact that there was no compulsion. Not that someone couldn't claim the privilege because there might be a fear of penal consequences, but that the particular program that was run, you weren't compelling someone to provide those admissions, and therefore there was no violation of the privilege.
McCune didn't deal with any distinction between charged and uncharged, did it?
I don't believe so. In fact, I mean, I think part of the issue in that case was uncharged, but I don't think there was a distinction in that regard.
Mr. Wolford, can we address for a minute the issue of what should happen on remand? Should there be another hearing? That's my understanding of the position that you've taken, if desired.
Well, we were following the Evans approach, but really the case should be the revocation. We're attempting to follow what happened in Evans. The the revocation should be vacated, and Mr. Tate should have a chance to go back through sex offender treatment after being warned of what immunity would be applied to him. And then if he still chose to deny, then he could be revoked.
But it makes no sense to send it back for another revocation hearing, because the only grounds for revocation was his flunking out of sex offender treatment because he refused to talk.
Right. There would be another revocation hearing if now he said, I've got this immunity, I'm still not going to talk.
A subsequent revocation hearing based on subsequent refusal after being immunized. So you're not suggesting that we should send it back for another revocation hearing on the present state of affairs?
No.
Okay. What about the perjury issue? I think you were going to address that but didn't get to it. He is perpetually exposed to a perjury prosecution, not just up until the time his direct appeal is completed, but into perpetuity, right?
Well, I think that the immunity that we're requesting would protect him against perjury for perjury committed at the trial. And yes, he is subject to that potential danger, unlike somebody who didn't testify at trial.
Okay, so the rule should apply to that.
Yes. I think the general rule in immunity statutes and the general rule overall is that it doesn't, if you give someone immunity, it doesn't apply to subsequent perjury, or it doesn't immunize you from committing perjury when you give the testimony that's been immunized. I think it would apply to,
looking back,
using that admission to say, well, you lied at the trial. I think I've covered all the various limits that we suggest on the rule.
I think that you covered my list of issues that seem to me to be possibly ones that you and the defendant debated. And on impeachment, State agrees that Evans has modified by, is it Thompson?
By Thompson, yes.
Yes. And that you're wary of the appeals court's decision on waiver.
Well, we just feel that we want to get the sex offender treatment started right away. And to some extent, since that decision came down, they've been delaying treatment, and that's what is the result of that sort of waiver, going back to the trial court, getting delayed. And so we think that this is a better approach that for all concerned, and it will better rehabilitate the probationer, and it will better protect the public.
The state says that limiting the scope only to not guilty pleas would be too narrow, and trying to extend it beyond that may not be good enough because the limits and the boundaries are not quite clear. Do I misstate that?
We feel that it could be extended to guilty and no contest pleas if there is an attack on the conviction being made. If someone has pled no contest and their time is up or they're not challenging the conviction, I think Carrizales and some of these other cases mandate that they have no...
Okay, so it's not limited. The point is it's not limited to just... not guilty pleas. There are other instances that might come under it and might not. And you think he's covered under perjury, but you would like to retain the rule that as to uncharged conduct, the treatment officer can ask about it in general ways and instruct that they will not be given immunity. You want to keep that.
Right. The DOC feels very strongly about that, and I think the Lyle case discusses, some reasons why you don't want to extend immunity in that type of situation, because you want people to accept the consequences for what they do, and it also provides deterrence in some cases. As I said, it's not a subterfuge. They're not doing this to try to run to the DAs, but they they have obligations as well, and they can't prevent someone necessarily from finding it out.
And I guess the state's position would be to stay away from Chapter 980 unless the court's willing to say anything goes in 980.
I would urge you not to address 980 issues in this particular case. So.
Well, because they're institutionalized.
Right.
Justice Sykes, I'm sorry.
Right, that's all right. 980 is implicated in another way here, to the extent that you're arguing that this should not apply to compelled admissions to uncharged conduct, because those compelled admissions to uncharged conduct could form the basis of a 980 commitment procedure at the end of the service of any sentence.
Well, if I understand your question, I guess I have two responses to it. One is, it's our position that you shouldn't deal and provide immunity to uncharged conduct admissions because the Department of Corrections is taking an approach so that there won't be any compulsion, so that they're not compelling this information, and because the information is not going to be incriminatory because they're asking for very general information. But also, we don't think that the privilege would be implicated there because Chapter 980 is not criminal in nature. Indeed, it may be a deterrent for some prisoners or probationers or whatever to not want to provide information because they're concerned about use in Chapter 980 down the road, but I don't think it's the privilege against self-incrimination that's applicable.
Maybe there. I've forgotten some of this immunity law, but it was my understanding on the privilege of incrimination, you could raise it in a non-criminal proceeding if it might subject you to other criminal proceedings.
Absolutely.
So the fact that 980 is civil would not stop somebody from raising the privilege of self-incrimination if what they were saying in a 980 proceeding or treatment might subject them to incrimination.
Then I've been misunderstanding the questions all along. That's certainly true. You can raise the privilege against self-incrimination in any sort of proceeding if you have a real and appreciable fear of
criminal proceedings.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't Chapter 980 say that a Chapter 980 respondent has all of the constitutional rights of a criminal defendant?
It does.
So, I know that's not directly implicated here, but it does go to the scope of this immunity.
And I don't really deal with the 980 cases. The type of situation we're talking about here is the treatment programs for probationers, not what they're doing with Chapter 980 people. I really don't know what their procedures are with respect to those issues.
The treatment programs that are used in this area are all quite similar, are they not? The ones that are used for the people on probation for sex offenses, the ones that are used for prisoners who are incarcerated in prison for sex offenses, and once that file of admissions is created, it stays with that person so long as they're in the system, incarcerated on paper, whatever.
I guess I really don't know how close, how similar they are, the various programs. I'm most familiar with, what they do in the probation setting. I know that they have other programs for inmates. I'm not that familiar with the sex offender programs related to sex predator.
Mr. Walford, thank you very much for your argument. Your red light is on, and we'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal by Attorney Jerome Buting.
Thank you. Counsel, I want to start out with State versus Evans. And we ran out of time with your opposing counsel. Perhaps this question is more appropriate to him. But as I recall, State versus Evans, the impeachment issue now is aside. You know, that's taken care of. Evans involved uncharged crimes in the context of a probation agent, telling a probation agent. And when we consider uncharged crimes in the context of a sex treatment offender, I have difficulty saying that distinction, that the uncharged crimes to a treatment professional as opposed to a probation professional makes any difference. Now, I'm asking the wrong person, but what is the difference?
Well, I agree. There really isn't a difference and shouldn't be a difference. And one reason Evans ruled that way was that the court concluded that it was in society's interest that probation agents be able to account for the whereabouts and the activities of clients when they're out in the community, and that requires full disclosure and discussion of potentially even criminal conduct. But in order to achieve that balance and to encourage that, they provided immunity from subsequent criminal prosecution. Similarly, in a sex offender treatment setting, what I understand the state proposing, I agree it's not workable because we have this sort of a game that would be played, you know, don't ask, don't tell situation where, you know, we're going to ask you a little bit, but we don't want you to tell too much. What should be encouraged by this court is the free exchange between the sex offender treatment provider and the client of any sexual history that's relevant to their treatment. And if you're going to do that best, you're going to do it with giving them immunity, just like you would have in a doctor-patient privilege, where someone can feel free to disgorge themselves of all whatever horrible things they may have done in the past. And that's not going to happen if you have the therapist sitting there saying, well, you know, giving them like a Miranda kind of warning, now don't tell me too much. You know, if you give me the names of anybody, any identifying information about the neighborhood girl or whatever, I'm going to have to report you. That's not going to encourage someone to be open and honest and get the kind of treatment that they need. It's going to do just the opposite. And, you know, in most of these cases, it can be very difficult to draw a line between, you know, talking about some prior sexual misconduct they may have done and who it was that they did it to, because we all know that most of these cases, they're usually victims that are close to them, be it relatives.
On occasion, they are victims who are close to them.
Right.
But you, on occasion, have sex offenders who have engaged in many, many sexual offenses. So if someone is convicted of one sexual offense and they've had they've sexually assaulted 30, 40, 50, 60 children, those are supposed to be confession forgiven?
No.
What happens when they all of a sudden talk about the 50 kids that they've sexually abused?
Justice Stevens talked about this in his dissent in McCune. They don't get a pass on that. Evans doesn't require transactional immunity. It doesn't require that just because you've discussed it in treatment, you can never be prosecuted for that. It simply says that you can't be punished by the use of statements that we compel from you and build a case that way. The state can still prosecute uncharged offenses of the 50 or 60 or whatever it is that...
Well, how does it... So the state finds out about them. So the state doesn't know about them until, as Justice Bradley indicated, you get the 50 other people. You can't use that.
it has to be brought to the state's attention in some other way, right?
They would have to, under Castigar, the Castigar rule, they would have to demonstrate that they had a legitimate independent source in order to prosecute. Like, that's what the Fifth Amendment involves. I mean,
just let me just follow through. So the rule you're reciting says that it has to be brought to their attention independently, or just explain that so I understand. In other words, you get the 50 people, and the immunity is that nobody in that capacity, I'm talking about the therapist or the treatment director or some subordinate, can never say, well, gee, this is awful. None of that information can be transmitted, correct?
Right.
I
think what I'm saying is that the Evans rule of immunity should be extended, basically. I mean, Evans has been the law for 25 years, and the sky hasn't fallen, and probation agents have been able to deal with this, and the state's certainly been able to prosecute other crimes, even if someone admits to their probation agent. Similarly, if the state wants to prosecute uncharged conduct that they have a legitimate independent source of information from, I think the Evans rule would apply. It's the simplest, easiest resolution of it, and it's silly to have these kind of warnings that, you know, don't tell us any identifying information, but tell us what you did.
Thank you, Mr. Buting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buting, and thank you, Mr. Wolford, for your argument in 00-1635 State X Rel Gary Tate versus David Schwartz.